Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. Known as Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers is widely considered to be the cradle of the Western world. Although home to many peoples, it was the Sumerians who earned the right to be called the world's first true civilization. A land of great achievement and constant warfare, the Mesopotamian landscape would be the first home to power and politics that set the course for the modern age. On this episode, we discuss the Fertile Crescent. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the legacies they left behind that shape our modern world. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer. You can visit my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. Season 1 of the series has been an overwhelming success, greater than I ever imagined it could be, and it was successful because of listeners like you. All of us as historians have this greater need, this deeper desire to understand our world, where we come from and where we're going. And a history podcast is truly a community. All of us together, myself as the host, of course guided by your words of advice, again on Twitter, through email, topics you'd like to think of and talk about, have made Wartime a history podcast, the fastest growing history podcast on the web. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for that. But now, in Season 2, we're going to begin to expand our topics of discussion. Again, myself personally, as a historian of empire, I've had the chance, I've had the opportunity to study and examine cultures around the world, how they operate and form into the identity we know today as empires. So in this season, in this series, we're going to focus on the empires of the ancient world, because they can seem like they take place in distant lands, they can seem like they take place in distant times, but when you begin to examine them, when you begin to extrapolate that valuable information about the culture, about the identity, about the vision that these individual peoples had for the world, whether they be the Sumerians, whether they be the Babylonians, whether they be the Assyrians or the Egyptians, you'll see that there's always a small piece of them left behind, a small piece of them that is integral in creating the living structure, the building block that is the modern Western world. I'm very excited about this season, and together here in episode 1, we'll begin our exploration. Now, we're going to do it first by laying some groundwork. I think one of the things we really have to focus on is how different the ancient world really is from anything we have today from our own experiences. In the last season of Wartime, we talked about the 18th century, and yes, it is 250 years ago. But it must be understood that, as far as historians are concerned, we very much consider that to be the modern world. Now, certainly the language is different, certainly the powdered wigs have fortunately gone out of fashion, but that is very much a living end product or byproduct of who we are. Now, in this season, things are going to become more challenging and therefore endlessly more fascinating, because we're going back to the beginning. We're going back to the formative time of civilization, who we are, and where it comes from. When we're talking about the earliest experience in the history of the Western world, and of course, by Western world, we mean the modern Middle East, Europe, and North America, We have to trace our origins back to the place where it all started, and that place is going to be in the modern Middle East today, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers we call Mesopotamia. Today, Mesopotamia is the nation-state of Iraq, and as Westerners, we are all too familiar with that place after more than a decade of war in the region. But we have to understand that the Mesopotamia of 5,000 years ago was very different than the Mesopotamia of today. And again, that's sort of where I want to begin this discussion. We will get to the great cultures of the Mesopotamian world. In fact, we're going to take two episodes to explore them. But I want to lay the groundwork. I want to get the fundamental beginnings of why there. Because it's a question that for most of history, human beings never considered. And when they did, they never really had a satisfactory answer for. In the early 2000s, a naturalist from UCLA named Jared Diamond released a book that, in my mind, changed the way we view human history. The book was called Guns, Germs, and Steel, and I would highly recommend it. But what Guns, Germs, and Steel was all about was answering the question of why there seemed to be such a huge disparity between the haves and have-nots in the world. It was nothing to do with their skin color. Biologically, there's nothing involving race that equates to intelligent, and there are many highly intelligent people in undeveloped parts of the world. So there must have been something else. Why did Europeans have the money? Why did Europeans have the power? Why did Europeans have the means to conquer what we would think of as the known world? That's the question that was addressed in Guns, Germs, and Steel. And it does get us back to Mesopotamia, which is why I say bear with me as we discuss this topic. But I want you to think about the world as you know it. Now, this podcast is recorded in the United States of America. And as I travel across this country, I see things that, to my eyes, have no business being where they are. But they're only there for one reason. And the reason is imperialism. And imperialism is the name of it all. But when I see animals, like cows, like goats, like sheep, when I see cereal grains, like wheat, like oats, like barley, I see the grains that developed, and the animals, the Western world. But what if I told you that before 1492, before Columbus, there was never a single cow, goat, or sheep in North America? And even more than that, there was not one strand of wheat, oats, or barley, the very grains that, in many ways, define the Midwestern part of the United States. It's a bizarre and unusual set of circumstances. But it's a very real fact. Those things did not exist in the Western Hemisphere until they were brought over by Europeans in the 15th century. So if they don't exist here, where do they come from? Well, you can trace their origins back to Europe and Asia, certainly. But as you begin to dig deeper, you'll find you can even trace their origins back farther than that. Imagine a world without civilization. Imagine a world where hunting and gathering, we'll describe that as a Paleolithic lifestyle. Paleolithic being Greek, meaning old, paleo. Lithic, of stone, the old stone age in the world. Very few people grew anything that resembled their own food. Everyone hunted, and everyone gathered. Now, if you're going to be a hunter and gatherer, you can really only hunt and gather the flora and fauna that exist around you. In North America, pickings were slim. You had deer, you had elk, you had some giant mammals, but you had very few productive grain crops at all. Maize, what we think of in America today as corn, was effectively invented in Mesoamerica to fill that very need. As you go into different parts of the world, you'll see every region has their own naturally occurring grain or crop. In East Asia, it's rice. But in the Middle East, and this is endlessly important, the plants and animals that just occurred naturally were the very animals that have sustained the growth of the Western world. Goats, cattle, sheep, pigs, wheat, oats, and barley. Now, we know these animals and plants today as ideal farming plants, cash crops, in a lot of different ways. But at the time, they weren't thought of that at all. They were just what happened to grow nearby. So why is a place like Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, the land between two rivers, the place where civilization begins? Well, it's not because the people are any smarter, or the people are any more innovative, or the people are any more intelligent. Across the world, you basically see an equality, genetically, on intellectual capability. It begins there because they have the head start. They have the plants and animals occurring just by random chance of nature that give them the best chance to be successful. So what do we mean by this? Well, let's take a look at wheat, oats, and barley. We'll call these cereal grasses. How do you plant wheat, oats, and barley? Well, let's compare it to something like an apple tree. If you're starving, if you're hungry, and you need to eat, and you have an apple seed, you can plant that seed, but you're not eating for some time. You're not eating for many months or years. You have to procure the seed. You have to watch it grow. You have to tend it until it becomes a tree. And then eventually, apples will fall off of it. You'll be long gone before you get any nutritious sustenance from that plant. Compare that, a very exhaustive, time-consuming plant, with wheat, oats, and barley. Well, how do you grow that? Well, it's grass. There's a reason we have to cut it every week in the summer. You take a handful of those seeds and you throw them. And they grow very fast and they grow very easily. Now, compare those two plants. One is clearly much better for farming than the other. Again, it's a matter of geography that gives the Fertile Crescent a head start over everyone else. They have the best plants and animals. If you look at, say again, the Mesoamerican people of North America before Columbus, what animals do they have to farm, to domesticate? Well, they have llamas, and they have alpacas, and they have vicunas. And these are all very similar animals. They do produce wool, but they don't produce milk, and you never really use them for meat. Now look at the animals of the Fertile Crescent. Cows, goats, sheep, and pigs. Not only are these animals very big and very docile, but more importantly than that, they are herding animals. So if you want to move 200 cows, you don't really have to move them one at a time. You really have to move only a few, what we can call leaders of the pack, and they will follow the lead. Animals ideally suited by their very nature for farming. Not so easy to, say, domesticate a pack of wolves in that regard. So look around the world. Look at all the animals available. The Fertile Crescent has the natural gifts to give them a head start in farming, growing their own food, into what we would consider to be the Neolithic Age. That is, if the Paleolithic Age was the Old Stone Age, you don't have to know Greek or Latin to be successful in this regard, but you'll learn some. The Neolithic Age is the New Stone Age. And the one thing that differentiates the Neolithic Age from the Paleolithic Age is farming. The Fertile Crescent has the greatest natural gifts. The people aren't any more innovative. The people aren't any more intelligent. They have a natural blessing of geography. And that's really where this story begins. What does the Fertile Crescent look like? What would it feel like? What would it be like if you were there 5,000 years ago? Well, when we think of Iraq today, we can think of a very large nation, roughly the size of Texas, that's mostly hot, dry, flat desert. And that is true to a degree 5,000 years ago as well. But there's something very important about the Tigris and Euphrates River that we have to understand to get any of this. And not only understand this episode and these people, but also subsequent empires and civilizations in the future. And it's this. The Tigris and Euphrates rivers do what all rivers do. They flood. And when they flood, they fundamentally transform the landscape, hot, dry, and arid, which we just described, into not only a place where farming can exist, but into a place where farming, settlement, and civilization can flourish. The Tigris and Euphrates River will flood a few times throughout what we'd consider to be today a calendar year. Now, you're not certain when the flood will happen. You're not certain how much or how little it will flood. But you know that eventually it will. And when it floods, it will pull a lot of very dark, very rich soil from the river floor called silt and spread it throughout. throughout the hot, arid desert. What this does is transform the land into an agricultural mecca. Now, this is an amazing thing, but I want you to consider this. Where this podcast is recorded, the United States of America, we have every summer a large corn harvest. You wait till late July, early August, and you have delicious sweet corn to eat for dinner. Now, you plant that corn early in the year, and you pick it whenever it's ready. You get one harvest from the North American soil, which by all accounts is reasonably fertile. In the Fertile Crescent, there were, consider this, not one harvest per year, but as many as sometimes three harvests per year of crops. That's how fertile that soil is. Three harvests per year. They couldn't grow food fast enough. So this is not some small measure we're dealing with here. It's a fundamental fact of life that when the rivers flood, as inconsistent as they may be, you plant food, you eat, and civilization develops. So that's the world you're seeing there. You still have a lot of hot, dry desert all around it. But between those two rivers, the land the Greeks called Mesopotamia, literally meaning between the two rivers, you had an ideal place for civilization to develop and a new way of life to flourish. Now, before this, people are, as we said, hunters and gatherers. The men have one job, which is to hunt, and the women have one job, which is to gather. No one is a specialist. No one is an expert. Yes, there are better hunters than others, but for the most part, everyone has the same job. If you have your food, if you find it early, your day is done. If you strike out, as most hunters do, then you unfortunately aren't eating that day. But when you can harness the power of agriculture, and when you can grow your own food, your life changes in a completely new direction. And there is no going back to a hunting-gathering lifestyle once you begin to produce your own food, once you begin practicing agriculture. And as a result, civilization naturally occurs as well. People don't have to migrate with the food. They can stay in one place. When they can stay in one place, they build homes. Suddenly, family clusters develop. Suddenly, villages develop. And before long, towns and cities will develop as well. Now, in today's episode, we're going to focus on a very specific time period in the ancient world, and it is a transformative one. It goes from about the year 3000 BCE, that's 5,000 years before today, to about the year 2000 BCE. It's a very long stretch of time, a 1,000-year stretch of time, that as archaeologists is described as the Bronze Age. Now again, I am a historian, I'm not an archaeologist. I'm not going to pretend to be. But when studying the ancient world, history and archaeology, which at times can be very far apart, are actually very much on the same page. They have to be for us to successfully understand this time period. So why do we call it the Bronze Age? Well, the people who lived at the time didn't. But we call it the Bronze Age because around the region, regardless of what people you're talking about, you're beginning to see the cultivation, the production, and the specialized use of metal tools. Again, as you can imagine, most notably, bronze. Now, how do you make bronze? Well, let's start at the beginning. You're not going to dig bronze out of the ground. You could dig forever and never find it. But you are going to dig the ingredients you need out of the ground. Bronze, very simply, is the amalgamation of copper and tin. And it's about 9/10 copper, and again, 10% tin. It takes experimentation to create this metal. It takes time. If you're hunting and gathering all day, you're not going to have the time to experiment and to take the passage of trial and error it'll need to create these weapons. You're not going to have time to mine the copper and mine the tin it'll take to create these weapons. So again, the discovery of smelting metal really is not possible unless you are in a sedentary environment as a byproduct of growing your own food. So again, here we are, the Fertile Crescent. The people aren't any smarter than anyone else in the world. They aren't more capable of anyone else in the world. They just have the head start and the blessing of geography. So we have bronze tools as the primary mechanism of success around this region. And it's for that reason, from 3000 BCE to 2000 BCE, we describe this as the Bronze Age. This is all some basic upfront material to help you navigate Season 2 of Wartime a little better. Because these topics are not easy, but when you consider who we are today, you can see the legacy of this all around us. In about the year 3000 BCE, after you have long periods of farming, after you have long periods of sedentary life, you do begin to see the first signs of what we would think of as civilization. And what these earliest signs of civilization are, in my opinion, are the things that make us human today. Of course, I'm talking about the things that separate us, the desires we have that seem to be injustices in the world. So what do we mean? Well, in a hunting-gathering society, if you're competing over resources like food or land, someone is going to fight someone else. Someone's going to be killed. Now, even if that land was yours, it can be taken from you. And who's there to mediate? Well, civilization, as it emerges, is, in my opinion, the mediation of those issues. And that's exactly what we see. About 5,000 years ago, about the year 3000 BCE, we begin to see people in this region of Mesopotamia mediating conflicts. They use logic, and they use reason, and they use what begins to look like, not quite there yet, but what begins to look like the foundation of the rule of law to separate who is right, who is wrong, and what punishments, if any, can be found. We begin to see man reaching for the stars. We begin to see man asking questions that we still do not have answers for today. They begin to say, why am I here? What is my purpose? Why am I in this spot on this earth, and what am I supposed to do? They begin to seek the wisdom of the heavens, the wisdom of the divine, the wisdom of the gods. Religion and civilization go hand in hand, because not only does it provide, to some degree, answers for man's questions, but it also allows a community develop around that faith. And we will talk about the various religious figures of Mesopotamia as we continue with the discussion. We begin to see questions being asked that perhaps can't be answered from the great beyond. They can't be answered from the divine. And these, of course, are questions of science. The sun goes up, the sun goes down, the seasons change. Now, we at times can understate just how dedicated to science the early ancients were. We think about classical Greece and the Roman world as a highly scientific and logical place. But let's not understate the earliest and first civilizations in the Western world. Because you know, and that's the same is true today, if you are going to be a successful farmer, you've got to know when the seasons change. You've got to know when to plant. You've got to know when to harvest. Now, they don't have Doppler radar to help them understand the weather, but those people did have an understanding of the weather. So these are things that, again, we can't understate, and at times we can tend to write them off as a non-scientific or less scientific peoples. But remember, this is an agricultural society in Mesopotamia. So they are deeply entrenched, I can say, agriculturally, and probably agriculturally alone, in understanding how and why the world is doing what it does. So, we've been talking about this civilization for about 25 minutes now. Let's actually get to who the civilization is, because this is the meat of the next two episodes. We'll call the first peoples to develop in a civilized way in Mesopotamia, again, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in modern Iraq, we'll call them the Sumerians. The Sumerians will appear first by about 3200 BCE, but it takes, again, about 200 years for their culture to really catch up steam and really gain momentum to become what we think of as a civilization. When we talk about them, we have to understand there are dozens of small cities that emerge in Mesopotamia, in between the land between two rivers. And you have to understand that to understand why there is civilization. They're civilized, not because the way they live as individuals, but the things they have in common as a group. Now, we have to lay the groundwork like this, but here's what we can basically say. The individual cities which to be exact will be called city-states. All spoke a variation of the same language. They all had a variation of the same religion. They all had a same basic taste in art and music. They had what we would think of today as a collective identity. The issue they have, though, is that they never really saw themselves that way. Yes, they knew their language was the same. Yes, they knew their religions were the same. But like nations today that share those common bonds, they were at times allies. They were at times enemies. They were at times at war. This is what's difficult about this world. It's kind of like our modern world in a microcosm. They have diplomacy. They have negotiation. They have all of these things. Again, they can't get past their differences to see how similar they really are. As historians and archaeologists today, we can view them in the past, the benefit of hindsight, and say, well, these are one collective people with one collective identity. At the time, though, it would have been unheard of to think that. The various different cities of the Sumerian world between the two rivers in Mesopotamia were as different as the United States and Canada and the Great Britain and France and Germany today. Now, if they all spoke the same language, that would certainly complicate things. And this is our basic introduction to the ancient world of Mesopotamia. It challenges our modern view of how things should be. But remember, we're viewing this in their time, not ours. And we've got to understand the way they view the world to get the most out of this. So how do we know each one of these individual political entities between the two rivers were actually operating by basically the same rules? Well, as archaeologists, you can look at what remains of the sites and you can see striking similarities. And the first basic similarity we have, besides language and culture and customs, is something as simple as how they built their cities. They didn't live in cities as we think of them today, but they viewed each of their individual cities as its own small state, its own small nation. Just as today we differentiate our nations with artificial borders and perhaps a very colorful flag, they had their own sense of differentiating one city-state from the other. And again, that's the term we'll use, city-state. By our modern accounts, the area is about the size of an urban metropolis today, but they have their own sense of separateness. So it's critical we see this. But when we look at these individual city-states, one of the things we can't deny in the modern age is how similar they are, because they share a similar worldview. And again, if you've ever heard any previous episodes of Wartime, you'll know that empire is all about worldview. That's the key. And here's what we can say. Each of these independent city-states, at least they think as independent city-states, has four defining characteristics that really prove to us and really show us that they are on the same page, whether they recognize it or not, when they're defining their conception of what their city-state should look like. Every city-state has some form of defensive wall built around it. Defensive fortifications are key for them, and we know why. Defensive fortifications tell us these were people with very real fears of attack and invasion from the outside. Invasion from who? People by today's standards we consider to be neighbors, very similar, if not exactly, like them. Each city-state had access to water. Water was key. Most, if not all, of the major cities in the world today also are on some form of water form, whether it be a lake, a river, or an ocean. That begins there. But it's all there. Every city-state is an urban area. People live in very tight quarters, very close together. And like today, they aren't growing their own food in the city. Like today in most major cities, the food they grow, the food they eat, the food that sustains them, the food they eat, is not grown in the city, but it's grown outside. Again, most of the United States today's farmland is used to feed people in cities. If you're in Manhattan, you're not exactly going to effectively grow a few plots of grain on Fifth Avenue, maybe Central Park, but certainly not there. So they all have that surrounding farmland, which even though it's outside the walls of their city-state, does belong to them. But perhaps most revealing, and this is only in my opinion, someone who tends to look at the cultural and social aspects of a people more than anything else, more than any other systematic entity that exists within them. is the fact that every major city-state has a very distinct and a very large religious temple in the center. Now, they come in all shapes and sizes, that's true. But they are always the largest building in the city-state. So that tells us that they are very practical people. Access to food, access to water, anxious to defend what they have. But it also shows that their religion, the way they view the divine, the way they view their spiritual nature, is all very similar across the board. And again, these are dozens of city-states that would all view themselves as different. Looking back, though, we have to look for these clues. We have to look for these features of their life that identify them as who they are. The Sumerian peoples clearly are an advanced culture, and they clearly are a unified people driven forward to success with a unified identity. Never forget, though, politically they are distinct. And in political distinctions, you have wars, you have battles, all fueled by competition. It would be ridiculous for us to say that in the year 3000, they were everything they were ever going to be, because that could not be farther from the truth. And as archaeologists and historians, what we do is look at what they leave behind, and we try to seek out patterns. We try to differentiate one group from the other, one time period from the other, by the physical remains that they leave behind. And when you begin to lay all of that out, you begin to see that there are very distinct patterns of development amongst the Sumerian peoples of Mesopotamia that we can see. Now, I don't want to spend too much time, although we could, on each individual period of Sumerian existence, but we will touch on each of them in a very brief way to get a better understanding of who they are and where they come from. The earliest period that we can see that we've talked about is called the Ubaid period. And this is what we've been talking about thus far, this very rough-hewn, early Neolithic world where agriculture and civilizations really just starting to merge together. But I think the much more telling development, the much more expansive and meaningful development will come next. It's a time period we call today, by our modern standards, the Uruk period. And the Uruk period for the Sumerians is the time period where they really begin to shape who they are and really begin to show fundamental progress that will take them toward a new way of life, which we'll think of as the world's first civilization. We call it the Uruk period because the artifacts found at one of the remnant city-state sites called Uruk gives us an insight into this world. But it's during this first time period that we, as moderns, create for these people. We see incredible innovations develop. We see the world's first example of a wheel. We see the world's first example of a plow. We see the planting of not just wheat, oats, and barley, not early farming, but we see the world's first orchards, orchards of dates, orchards of figs, orchards of olives. Orchards are very different than throwing a handful of grain and watching it grow. Orchards are typically much hardier plants, in most cases trees, and they indicate very different things. You can plant some grain for a season, okay, that will sustain you. But when you plant an orchard, that clearly indicates to the historian and the archaeologist that whoever planted it is going to remain in that place for not just one season, and not just two seasons, and not even just three seasons, but far beyond that. So the presence of these orchards reveals to us as the historians and archaeologists, these are people that clearly understand that they not only want to stay in one place for a very long time, but they certainly know that they can. We see a lot of different things in the Uruk period. We see, again, we talked about the creation of bronze from copper and tin. We really see bronze go from an experimental phase in the Uruk period to an integral part of life, which means, to us, they figured it out. They understand the potential and the power that comes from sophisticated metalworking. The age of experimentation is over. They have a system that works. But perhaps, and well, certainly, the most powerful innovation that comes from the Uruk period is the creation of writing. The writing system, and this is the first writing system in the history of the Western world, and it's the first writing system that all others are based off of, will emerge during this time period by the Sumerians. The system they use is called by the Greeks, and it's the name we still use today, cuneiform. And cuneiform basically means wedge-shaped. But what they create is a written language. To this point in the world, language has been a completely vocal phenomenon. But now, with the creation of writing, these people are operating in the abstract. They don't not only see the power of communication face-to-face, but they develop a system, they invent a way of communicating with a person that you'll never see and you never know existed. So when we read some of these old cuneiform tablets we still have from the Mesopotamian world, we are effectively communicating with a person that lived 5,000 years before us. And who knows, in 5,000 years, people still may be reading it. But it shows the power of writing, the creation of writing. Writing is the beginning of it all. You know, people always ask me, what's the difference between prehistory and history? Because those are both very valid, and believe it or not, very specific terms. The difference between prehistory and history, something being prehistoric or historic, very simply, is the invention of writing. If there's something written that we can use, it's historic. If it's before writing, it's prehistoric. It's just that simple. But the Uruk period is when it all comes together for these people. And it's why it's so important that we spend the time we have on it. We'll see the Sumerians, though, move out of that. We can tell, based on the sophistication not only of what they leave behind, but the sophistication of the ideas they develop. The next period of the Sumerian world is called the pre-dynastic period. And it's during this time we begin to see, all because of writing, complicated mechanisms of social control develop. We begin to see cities grow. We now see cities that count their members in the thousands. We see some Sumerian cities that cover as much as 5 square miles. So these are not small outposts in the desert. We're talking about a city that covers 5 square miles. We talked about the dozens of cities that exist between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia. You have over 30 of them, all operating at full capacity during this time period. And it's overwhelmingly impressive. We know the names of some of these cities. Cities like Babylonia, cities like Kish, cities like Uruk, cities like Lagash. I mean, these are cities that are built into our minds, into who we are, our DNA, as ancient old cities. And they are the first. These cities, again, go to war. And they go to war frequently. What do they go to war over? Well, think of what they have in common. Yes, common language. Yes, common perceptions. Yes, common interests. But they also have common needs. And they're going to compete for those needs. They need access to water. They need good farmland. This is what they go to war over. And during this time period, we'll see warfare become a way of life. There's no question. Most of these city-states, by the year 2700 BCE, so we're 300 years in, fall into such a period and such a state of interstate warfare that it fundamentally transforms how they view themselves. Think of the United States of America today. It's been around for under 250 years. And if you ask the average American, it might as well have been around forever. We just covered a 300-year span for the Sumerians, longer than the existing United States of America, and we did in a flash. And it goes to show that when you talk about the ancient world, you really can't lose track of time. Very long periods can be generalized into very short periods. But in the year 2700, the Sumerian city-states who share so much begin to define themselves by how they fight one another. Times are chaotic. Times are uncertain. They begin to change the way they view how they should live, and more importantly, how they should be controlled. It's during this period of tumult and warfare, we see the development of two major figures in terms of titles and positions emerge in the Sumerian world. One of the positions is Lugal, which relatively translates to the big man. And the second period is what we think of as Enzi, or governor. Now, what does this mean? Well, during this time of war, people were afraid. Warfare brings the people together, but it also pulls out, and this is very much in human nature, some of their greatest fears. Their fear is brought to the forefront in this time period of war. You never know when the next attack will come, and you never know when you may be called into battle. So when people are afraid, they tend to give up liberties. Benjamin Franklin famously said, "Those who are willing to sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither." And this is a very good example of that. People put their faith in the strongest and bravest amongst them. It's a form of dependence. And they consolidate power, which was in the hands of a few, by most cases, in Mesopotamian cities and Sumerian cities. And they put them in the hands of this Enzi, or this Lugal, this one singular figure. He is first and foremost a leader of men on the battlefield, but during times of peace, he will be looked to continue his leadership through political means. What we're seeing is the beginning of the conception that we think of in our Western world as a king, as a leader, as a notion of kingship. And these early kings will really take the Sumerian world, which is, although very similar, tending to be very scattered, and consolidating them down. It's the fear and the constant threat. It's the way of life, the warrior life, for the better part of a century, that brings these city-states into such a point where power can be grabbed by one man. So, in the first part of episode 1 of season 2 of Wartime, I think we have a very good basic foundation for who the Sumerians are, what they brought to the table, how they view themselves, and how they define themselves. But we really can't know who they are until we bring another party into the discussion, until we bring in another people to compare them to. So far, though the Sumerians have been battling one another, despite their similarities, we haven't really seen them tested from the outside. We haven't really seen them challenged from an outside aggressor. In the next episode, that's exactly what we'll do. Thank you for joining me. I'm very much looking forward to season 2. For the first time this year, I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.